from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we'll split the hour with concentration in the first half on the ongoing investigation of the murder of Chauncey Bailey and the work of the award-winning Chauncey Bailey Project. In the bottom half of the hour, we get reaction and analysis to President Bush's advocacy yesterday of opening up areas presently not open for oil drilling. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. On August 2, 2007, Oakland Post journalist Chauncey Bailey was gunned down in downtown Oakland, murdered with three shotgun blasts by a man wearing a ski mask. Bailey purportedly had been working on a story about violence and financial fraud associated with Your Black Muslim Bakery in North Oakland. 19-year-old Devondre Broussard, a handyman employed by the bakery, was arrested the next day. He confessed to the murder, but subsequently recanted. With suspicions aroused that Broussard did not act alone, the Chauncey Bailey Project was launched by New American Media, an association of 700 ethnic media groups, along with the Maynard Institute. And the project was loosely modeled after the Arizona Project, launched back in 1976 after Arizona Republic reporter Dan Bowles was murdered in a car explosion while he was investigating a story on the mafia. A much more high-tech collaboration, the Chauncey Bailey Project, which I must add, for full disclosure here, KQED Radio and this program has been involved in, won an Investigative Reporters and Editors Award for Crime Reporting and a Tom Renner Award. And in February, Chauncey Bailey posthumously received the George Polk Award for Local Reporting. This forum half hour, we want to focus on the work of the Chauncey Bailey Project and also the most recent findings in the ongoing investigation of the Chauncey Bailey killing. And joining us in studio is Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Chauncey Bailey Project, which again is a consortium of media organizations, including KQED, formed to continue the work of Chauncey Bailey and investigate the circumstances of his death. Good morning.
Good morning.
Have you here, Rosie. Welcome.
Thank you.
Peter Keene is also with us in studio, and Peter is Dean Emeritus of Golden Gate University Law School and has seen the police recording, which we're going to talk about and which made the cover of today's Oakland Tribune, of Yusuf Bey's conversation. Will help us analyze what it means in the course of this, and we'll tell you about that as we move along here. Peter, good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Also here in studio, Thomas Peel is an investigative reporter, works with the Chauncey Bailey Project, and is also with the Bay Area News Group. And welcome, Thomas Peel.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Glad to have you all here. And Rosie, let me begin with you just to get a sense of what this video means. It's getting a lot of attention.
Well, the video was in the police had this in their possession 4 days after the killing. I think the video is very important because you have Yusuf Bey the fourth talking about the killing in ways that indicate or potentially indicate a broader conspiracy involving the killing of Chauncey Bailey. And when the Bailey Project was conceived, as you said earlier, we really wanted to get at the bottom of what happened here, and there was a strong sense, could one young man like this have done this alone, and why would he do this? And I think the video begins to answer a lot of those questions and also raises questions in which we could not answer in this story about if this was in the possession of the police. Did they pursue these leads? Did they discount them? And the police will not discuss it with us, so we really couldn't answer that, but it raises other questions about the investigation as well.
There are some big questions about the police and their investigatory work here and how thorough it was or how lacking it was and why no one else has been charged. In fact, questions loom over this, and I'm just interested in hearing you talk a little bit about why this case is so important. You've said, in fact, it's a journalist member of a family, really.
Yeah, we've talked about that, and I think the message here when we got together initially, and the credit really for conceiving this goes to Sandy Close, as you mentioned, from New American Media, and Dory Maynard from the Maynard Institute. They asked me to come in about a month later. But I think, in this country, the assassination killing of a journalist is very rare in the line of doing their work. The last killing that the Committee to Protect Journalists says happened was in 1992. And I think the message here was that if a journalist is killed because of their work, the family, the fraternity, the sorority, whatever you want to call it, is going to come and finish the work so that the message is sent that if this happens in this country, there will be accountability. Journalists are targeted around the world every day, beaten, killed, arrested, detained. It is not normal in this country to face violence. And we really wanted to send a message.
Again, Robert Rosenthal is the executive editor of the Chauncey Bailey Project. Thomas Peel is an investigative reporter who's been working on this project. And this is, it's so confounding here, I mean, to try to move through this whole morass, really, in terms of, again, just how much the police let go and just how much Yusuf Bey IV, who was just mentioned by Rosie, was involved. And he's sort of the one who has taken over this operation. From your standpoint as investigative reporter, I'd like to actually hear what I'd like our listeners to hear, which is from this video that was mentioned. And this is this will be explanatory in just a moment. Let's hear it. Tom, we're going to bring this down and have you talk over it to what we're hearing here.
Sure. What you're hearing here is Yusuf Bey IV, his half-brother Joshua Bey, and a bakery employee named Taman Halfin, who were left alone in a police interrogation room for about 2 hours with a camera running. This was recorded in relationship with an unrelated case. They're charged with kidnapping and torture of two women that allegedly occurred about a year ago. They were arrested the day after Bailey was killed in a raid of the bakery. Several days later, police feigned car trouble while they were moving them between jails in Alameda County and placed them in this room, and the officer who did so has testified that the hope was that they would make incriminating statements about the kidnapping case. In addition to doing that, they discuss, as we just heard, Mr. Bailey's murder, and Yusuf Bey IV says far more in this video than he told the police in a pair of interrogations a few days earlier.
We'll hear from Peter Keene about just how revelatory that all is. But as I said, you know, getting through all of this, you mentioned the torture and kidnapping charges. The patriarch, Yusuf Bey, who died of colon cancer a few years ago, was involved in all kinds of activities, alleging molestations and pedophilia and assault. And I mean, you just uncover one story after another here, and there were dead bodies, certainly, that have not been explained. I mean, this just, it seems like we got the tip of the iceberg.
We, as Rosie often says, we're peeling back an onion. And it, sometimes it seems like we peel back a chunk of the onion and we don't find another layer. We find another whole onion. We've reported things ranging from unsolved homicides to campaign finance violations to welfare fraud to child molestation. Quite honestly, other than the East Bay Express, the Bay Area media hadn't done hard reporting on the bakery for years, and we're finding a lot of things here that have a deep history that haven't been reported.
And what about the police? I mean, there were about almost a year and a half went by before this particular event occurred, the murder of Chauncey Bailey, and there were all kinds of things. There were dogs that were running wild. There were people shooting from rooftops and all sorts of really pretty serious kinds of things. No arrests.
We have reported that there were numerous events at the bakery in which arrests weren't made. And as you say, everything from dogs to reports to guns to reports of gunfire, there were instances. We reported one instance where Yusuf Bey was, the fourth, was involved in a car stop right in front of the bakery. The police officer ran his driver's license, found out that there was a warrant for his arrest issued out of Superior Court in Contra Costa County. As the policeman was making that check, Yusuf Bey walked into the bakery, and the police decided not to go in after him.
What we heard on that video, by the way, and I think the audibility was not very good. I hoped it'd be better. There's a lot that was enhanced in the first place, and we tried to get it even to sound better. But the gist of it was he admitted having a gun. He described the murder.
He admits on this video that he was in possession of the shotgun that was used to kill Mr. Bailey directly after the killing, and he expresses relief that it was not found in his possession when police raided the bakery less than 24 hours after the shooting.
Pretty damning, Peter Keene, isn't it?
It is very damning, and it raises lots of very profound questions. Again, you go back to the background that Rosie mentioned that you talked about, Michael, is that an assassination of a journalist in the United States is a very rare thing. It's something that we might expect in Moscow or Chechnya or Colombia. But a journalist who's doing investigation, particularly of a powerful group that's engaged in questionable activities in the United States, one would expect, since that goes to the heart of so many of our institutions, the First Amendment, the ability of people to get information, that you'd really have all the stops pulled down in an investigation and an A-team type effort. From what we're seeing in Oakland, it's a rather shoddy type of slipshod approach to the investigation itself. You look at the video of this young man, Yusuf Bey IV, who is the powerful person in this organization now, and he is miming the way the murder was committed in a rather brutal way. He's miming Bailey's head being hit, and he's miming it in a sense that he is reporting firsthand, this is what I saw. So he's saying, I was there. And also his accounts of having the gun. Those two things alone should call for Yusuf Bey IV to have been charged at least as an accessory. But then you have the other aspects of the fact that the investigators in this case used Yusuf Bey to essentially just deliver up, as Bey puts it in one of the exchanges in the video, a sacrifice of one of the members of the bakery to take the rap. And it seems like the Oakland Police Department just accommodated them on that, allowed that to happen, accepted it, and closed the books.
In fact, there was an officer named Longmire who did a lot of the investigating who says on the video, or at least we have record of him saying something about, you know, we want to protect the bakery.
Exactly. And you also have a background of Longmire having associations with Bey and Bey's father and a sort of a protectiveness about the bakery, and Longmire putting Bey in with the defendant who's now charged in a room alone, not recording it, and supposedly out of that, Bey being able to talk the defendant into, quote, taking the rap, or as Bey puts it on this video, sacrificing one of his soldiers. It seemed after all of that happened that the Oakland police and the Oakland District Attorney's Office just sort of said, well, we've wrapped it up. We've got this one character who's just a rather strange individual to given his background, to be the one who initiated this, pushed it forward. And it just cries out for the fact that these other people were involved, they were behind it, they did it. They should be the ones in the dock, and they're not.
We should mention we invited the Oakland Police as well as the DA's office to be part of this morning's program, and they both declined. I'm going to open up our phone lines. I'd like to hear from you, our listeners. One of the things that's sort of confronted me as a broadcast journalist is why there isn't more public outrage about this. I mean, certainly in Oakland there has been a lot of concern, but I'm talking about throughout the Bay Area and throughout Northern California. And as has been said here this morning, a journalist is gunned down on the trail of an important story, and one has to ask, why aren't we hearing more of a kind of, well, I would think very passionate outrage. At any rate, let me open up the phone lines and invite you to join us. If you have something you'd like to ask about this case, or if you have something you'd like to say, we welcome your phone calls. It's toll-free 866-733-6786. And as I said, there's a kind of unprecedented headline in today's Oakland paper, catching up with the story, and unprecedented in the sense it's both the top and the bottom covering the story. You can join us again toll-free now at 866-733-6786 or send an email, and our email address here is simply forum@kqed.org. And Thomas Peel is about, I keep thinking about Rosemary Wood, 7 minutes here left alone, right, unaccounted for and not recorded.
In this instance, Devondre Broussard was claiming at first that he did not kill Chauncey Bailey. Police brought Yusuf Bey IV, the head of the bakery, Broussard's spiritual leader, into an interrogation room with him and left them alone for 7 minutes. There was recording equipment in the room. It wasn't turned on. 7 minutes later, Yusuf Bey was taken out of the room and Devondre Broussard confessed to the killing. He has said since, in recanting that confession, that he yielded to pressure from Yusuf Bey to falsely admit the crime.
Well, what about the van, Rosie?
Well, the van eyewitnesses that morning told the police that they'd seen the gunman who came up and literally, you know, ran up to Chauncey Bailey in the middle of the street and shot him in front of witnesses three times. And once the final shotgun blast, when he was already lying on the ground, probably mortally wounded, run from the scene and jump in a van and saw the van, a white van, leave the scene. There's testimony from the owner of the van, who was working as a contractor at the bakery that morning, that he told the police, as a witness, that he that morning was asked by Yusuf Bey IV to borrow the van for some errands or some work, and that he personally gave the keys to Yusuf Bey, who left the van about an hour or so before, left the bakery about an hour or so before Bailey was killed, hour and a half, and returned. And he testified that Yusuf Bey, or told the police that Yusuf Bey returned the keys to him about a half an hour after Bailey was killed. That's what the police were told by the owner of the van. The owner of the van also identified another man by his photo as the man he saw driving the van away from the bakery that morning after he had given Yusuf Bey the keys. So based on those facts, it makes sense to take the next step and say, well, someone else was involved. And that, again, leads to a broader issue here. And again, we'd love to talk to the police and get their explanation of that those facts.
You've got to clamp down as far as the police are concerned?
Excuse
not,
me?
I say they've clamped down. They're not talking
to the police. The response from the Oakland Police Department, and we gave them a heads up on the story at least 10 days ago because we wanted to give them time. We told them we had the video. Was that it's an ongoing investigation and they can't discuss it.
Does that sound right to you, Peter King?
On the surface, yeah, if there is something very sensitive. But in regard to the things that are being raised, the things that are being raised are things that now are...
By the way, forgive me, that's the reason they said they didn't want to come on with us, too, that it's an ongoing investigation. But please proceed. Please.
Yeah, it does not... To go to the short answer, no, it doesn't sound right for a couple of reasons. One, given the nature, again, of the incident itself, the assassination of a journalist within Oakland, there should be some police response, at least to the community, as to what's going on. The police officers may decline to go into specifics, but they should at least be willing to engage in the discussions. And you take that with some of the other aspects of the things that we know about the investigation or the lack of the investigation. For example, one young man who apparently has some involvement and is charged, the attorney for, and is charged with other things, the attorney for that young man who knows all of these characters made an offer to the district attorney and the police department to furnish his client for discussions about his knowledge relating to the killings. Police or the district attorney never followed through on that. They've refused to follow through on it. It's so, in that sense, if there were something very sensitive that the police had that they were working on, that they wanted to protect, they could do that without just drawing this shroud around things, because the shroud around it seems to play into the whole notion, from what one sees here, that they got this one guy who was given up to them by Yusuf Bey IV, and they sort of closed it out at that, and they've left it at that. And all of these unanswered questions in this very profound scenario are now coming back to haunt them.
Well, we're going to go to your calls here. And again, that's Peter Keene, who's Dean Emeritus, Golden Gate University Law School. I want to bring our callers on. We'll go first to Kay in Oakland. Good morning, Kay.
Hey, good morning. That's actually not my real name, but one of the things I want to say is that the police, I'm a neighbor of the bakery, and the police told us we see nothing, we know nothing. And repeatedly we were told to keep our heads out of it, that the FBI was involved in it, and that we should just go about our business, because we were neighbors in that. The neighbors in that area knew everything that was going on, a lot of things, and it just wasn't being, we were told for our own safety just to stay out of it.
Well, thank you for that call. That pretty much, Tom Spiel, conforms to what you've talked to neighbors. And you know.
We've talked to neighbors who have made numerous complaints. We have records of years worth of telephone calls to the Oakland police by people in the bakery reporting gunfire, dogs, unattended children. I mean, a wide spread of complaints that appear to be not acted upon.
Robert Rosenthal.
Yeah, I just want to jump in on this. One of the things is, as of reporting the story out over the last 10 months, I've been a foreign correspondent in war situations. I was in apartheid South Africa. And I have not been around a story where so many people indicated their fear since I've been in those kinds of situations, and a visceral, fearful thing.
Fear of the bakery, fear of the police?
Well, I think fear around it. And lots of rumors, lots of speculation, tremendous amount of, in Oakland, someone told me that the truth is four layers removed from what you hear. So I think fear in general around all elements of this story. And let me just add one thing quickly. If you want to see this video, you can go to multiple websites. It's on the ChaunceyBaileyProject.org website, as well as the stories, the Oakland Tribune's website, the Center for Investigative Reporting.org website. So there's a way for the public to look at this if they haven't seen it yet.
And we'll hear from more of the public. We'll go to another caller in Oakland. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm also a neighbor, and that's also not my real name. My question is, there are some groups that were sympathizing with the bakery, and I was wondering if there's been any connection been made between the bakery and this incident and other incidents and the Uhuru movement, who protested in favor of the bakery when it was shut down. And I'm wondering if they're just anti-law enforcement, or if there's any evidence to connect them to the bakery on a more sinister level.
Jim, it's a good question. I want to get a response, but first let me get a question to you. Why are you giving us what are you afraid of here? Who are you afraid of in terms of giving another name?
The vestiges of the bakery, and the fact that I recently read that even though they're basically losing their that corner, or they may, there's some sort of plan that may have that family still owning property on that corner, and they may remain.
Okay. Thomas Peel, you want to answer his question?
Well, he's correct about the property. There's a bankruptcy proceeding that's going on now in which some of the property may be returned to Yusef Bey IV's mother. But the organization, as it existed as under Yusef Bey IV's leadership, is decapitated. He is in jail in Dublin in Santa Rita. I interviewed him there a week ago. He's facing 25 to life on kidnapping and torture charges. He's been accused of real estate fraud. He's facing assault charges in San Francisco, car theft charges in Solano County, numerous traffic violations in Contra Costa County. He's not going to be out of jail anytime soon.
There was a warrant for him in Contra Costa that wasn't honored. I mean, wasn't he supposed to be put in jail in Contra Costa County when the Oakland police picked him up?
They picked him up, did a car stop in front of the bakery. There was a no-bail warrant for his arrest for failure to appear in Contra Costa Superior Court. And again, by the time the police officer was done doing the driver's license check that led to him knowing that warrant existed, Bay 4 had gone inside the bakery compound and the police did not go in after him.
What about what the caller raised, Rosie, about support for the bakery?
I think the bakery over the years was a complicated organization in Oakland that had a lot of political power. It actually employed people who needed work. It was a very mixed view of them. For a lot of people in Oakland, they thought the bakery was a positive for Yusef Bey. The founder was seen as a powerful figure about black empowerment. Remember the era this came out of in the 70s. We found no indication that I'm aware of involving any other organizations being involved in these killings.
Well, we're coming up at the end of this half hour, a very enlightening half hour. It's been Tom in Oakland sends the following email. It's been my suspicion for many years there are individuals in the Oakland City power structure with connections to the Black Muslim Organization, gangs, and other criminal activity in and around Oakland. This is a clear case of corruption in the Oakland government and police department. Hopefully this case will bring national attention to a long-term problem. There's a lot of feeling out there about conspiracy and so forth. Congratulations on the work you've done with the Chauncey Bailey Project. Continue the good work, and maybe we'll get to the bottom of all this. Thank you all for being here. Peter Keene, Thomas Peel, and Rosie Rosenthal. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Yesterday, President George W. Bush called for an end to the 27-year ban on oil drilling in the United States-controlled waters to reduce U.S. dependency on foreign sources. Senator McCain supports the president's position, while Senator Obama opposes it. Since 1981, a congressional moratorium has prohibited oil and gas drilling along the east and west coasts and in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, which accounts for some 80% of the U.S. outer continental shelf. The president also renewed his call for the opening up to drilling of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and said that if Congress removes the ban imposed in 1982, he would lift an executive order prohibiting drilling for oil and gas on the U.S. outer continental shelf. That was issued in 1990 by George Bush Sr. Additionally, President Bush called for expediting of the regulatory process for the expansion of U.S. refineries and for Congress allowing access to oil, shale in the Green River Basin. This foreign segment, we want to focus on President's proposals and the question of whether to drill or not to drill. And let me tell you who is joining us for this half hour. We want to welcome, first of all, from Washington, D.C., Rayola Duher, who is Senior Economic Advisor of the American Petroleum Institute. We welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Also from D.C. and joining us is Jim Presswood. He's the lead lobbyist on federal energy policy issues with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. And welcome, Jim Presswood.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Well, let me begin with Rayola Duher. And this is, I guess, something that's looked at with a skeptical eye by many people as far as the intent of the oil industry. I'm sure you get a lot of that. That is, we're hearing that this is going to bring down oil prices and... Well, is it?
Well, you know, any operations, I think you're not going to see this for quite a long time, for up to five to ten years to do the development of some of these resources. But I think what would be important, if we had done this, for example, 10 years ago, we could have in the market today 1 million to 2 million barrels a day. That could really have a significant impact on the price, not only that we're paying, but the rest of the world as well. So I think it's difficult to know, you know, to come up with estimates of how much we're going to save, but I do know we do need this energy. It is available, and we have the technology to go after it in a way that we never could before. And we have the proof of that as well and how good the operations have been in the Gulf of Mexico. So I think it's time. The moratorium has been in place for decades. The technology has changed, and this industry would like an opportunity to go after and explore and develop and do this at home.
Well, you know, a lot of people get very gun-shy when they hear about drilling. They think, first of all, the effect on climate change and just the ecological damage that drilling is associated with. The ban, in fact, was there to protect tourism and lessen the chance of oil spills washing up on the beaches and so forth. What do you say to reassure people on that score?
Well, I think take a look at what happened during Hurricanes Rita and Katrina. Look at that record. Look at the two back-to-back storms of a century with 100-foot waves and 200-mile-an-hour winds and reports from the Mineral Management Service and the Coast Guard of no significant spills. And the reason for this is that they now require safety valves, and they have to be installed at least 100 feet below the mud line in each wellbore. So that really does prevent the spill, and their record in the Gulf is less spillage than the natural seepage from the ocean floor. You just really don't get much better than that.
Those rigs were pretty battered, too. Yeah.
Oh, they certainly were. I mean, that was a pretty big hit that the industry took, and were able to survive that, and especially back-to-back storms as well. So I think they have a great record, and the technology is just vastly improved from anything we had 10, 20, 30 years ago, or 40 in some areas.
That's the argument we're hearing, Jim Presswood, along with, in terms of going ahead with the drilling, along with new technologies and new fuel choices for consumers, perhaps Governor Schwarzenegger said would be preferable to this kind of drilling. But indeed... we're hearing certainly from the oil industry and others that it needs to be done, that it will save down the line, and that it's not the ecological nightmare we're hearing.
Well, you know, our first response to this is that, you know, with only about 3% of the world's oil reserves, there's just not really anything we can do to impact global prices of oil. And oil is set, the price of oil is set in the global marketplace. So what we do here in the United States on conventional oil is just not going to do anything to impact prices. And even the Department of Energy found in 2006 or 7 report to Congress that, you know, opening up the OCS in the lower 48 would not do anything to decrease prices over the next 30 years, and ultimately nothing really of significance to reduce prices. So the argument that we can really impact prices by opening up more resources in the Outer Continental Shelf just doesn't hold water. And also, really the solution here is not more drilling, but to break our addiction to oil. We need to be developing alternative sources of energy, using better energy efficiency so our cars can go further than a gallon of gas, being smarter about how we develop our cities, doing things, a lot of things that California has already done to try to conserve our gasoline and try to develop alternative fuels.
So you see this, do you, as a giveaway to the oil companies?
What I see is basically an effort to take the high gas price environment and try to push solutions that they've been pushing for years. And these are the old ways of the past, and we need a new energy future here, a future which includes solar energy, renewable electricity, and plug-in hybrids, and plugging your hybrid into the wall socket that's powered by a PV panel on top of your roof, things like that that we can do, and we have the technological capability and the resources in this country to do. We just need to put our minds to it and take action quickly.
What do you have to say about what we heard from Rayola Dewar about Katrina and Rita, about the devastation that didn't happen as far as oil is concerned?
Well, I think the folks in the Bay Area just need to remember what happened last November when you had a ship colliding with the Bay Bridge and spilling about 58,000 gallons of oil, and it pretty much fouled the coastline for more than 15 miles away and had impacts on wildlife and the fisheries. And, oil is an industrial process, and when you're doing it in a marine environment, there will be accidents, there will be spills. It's just a matter of time, and there's not a perfect system here. And so when you have coastal economies, they're so dependent upon their beaches and other natural environments for their economy, having a catastrophic spill would just devastate those kind of communities. So, and you also have just sort of the normal operating procedures for oil rigs. You have toxics that are emitted as a result. You have drilling muds that are used that contain toxics. They have water that comes up when you drill. That's a lot of it's dumped over the platform. And in the Gulf of Mexico, we find elevated levels of mercury around the platform. So this is not a clean industry. And you have the onshore infrastructure. This is an industry that has impacts, and yes, technology has improved, but still there's a lot more that could be done in the area of new clean energy technologies that don't have these kind of impacts.
Well, we hear that advocacy of clean green energy, and certainly many people will give credence to the notion that it's necessary, it's vital, in fact, as opposed to this dependency on fossil fuels. But for a while, at least, the dependency seems to be real where the economy is concerned, and according to President Bush, the Green River Basin potentially has three times the recoverable oil as the Saudi reserves, and that means, in many people's minds, less dependency.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of resource in oil shale in the Mountain West, as well as tar sands up in Canada, and other unconventional sources like turning coal into fuel. But with all of those, you have greenhouse gas emissions, global warming pollution emissions, that are almost twice to three times what you have with conventional fuel. And given the urgency of dealing with global warming and reducing global warming pollution, developing those kind of fuels is just not going to work in a future where we have to be cutting our emissions. And so we need to be developing alternative fuels, such as gasoline produced from grasses and other plants, and also algae, and new, innovative, efficient technologies such as plug-in hybrids, so you don't really have to use gasoline for your commute, things like that that we can do. And it is going to take some time to develop these technologies and fuels, but we need to take action now. Congress already took a good step by increasing vehicle fuel economy standards for the first time in over 30 years. They did that last December. We need to take the next steps, and we need to do so soon.
We're talking with Jim Presswood, who is lead lobbyist on federal energy policy issues for the Natural Resources Defense Council, and also talking to Rayola Dewar, who is senior economic advisor with the American Petroleum Institute. And you can join us here, by the way. Let me give out the phone number. In fact, we invite you to do so, whether you're listening to us on radio, Internet, or Sirius satellite. We welcome your phone calls. And the phone number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, our phone number available to you is 866-733-6786, and that is toll-free. You can also, if you prefer, send an email, and the email address here is simply forum@kqed.org. And we go back to Rayola Dewar and just raise the question with you, Ms. Dewar, about expanding the domestic oil supply and through exploration and through production. First of all, that means we're going to need more refineries right away, doesn't it?
No, it would mean we'd have less imports. We could import less, which would be a good thing for our balance of payments, and it would help shore up the dollar, too. If we had even a million extra barrels a day right now, that would make a difference on the world's market, because this thin line between supply and demand is only about 1.5 million barrels on the whole world. So we can have an impact on the price, an important impact, and an impact on our lives. That 1 million barrels a day is equivalent of 10% of the imports into the United States. We could get up to as much as 2 million barrels a day. That could be 20% of the imports. The point is not an either-or choice between the kinds of energy we're going to need in our future, because we are really challenged as a nation to come up with the energy we're going to need. And we are going to need natural gas. We are going to need more oil. And we're going to need renewables, too. And I think we do need to invest in new technologies moving forward. All of those things. But to pit one against the other is a flawed policy. I think we have to focus a lot on conservation. In the short term, that's where we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck. But we also have to look at our own nation's supply and our own resources, develop them responsibly, but let's bring it on, because certainly at these prices, we need to do something, and we need to have policy that does support supply and discourage demand.
But we're also going to need more roads and more pipelines and airports and housing.
And more infrastructure. You're absolutely right.
Processing plants. I mean, and we're probably inevitably going to have more spills. And there's a lot of apprehension about all that.
I understand that. I think that there is. And I think if you look at the record of the industry, they get better and better and better. And as a state or as a locality, you can hold them to the most rigorous standards. But as a society, we are driving our cars on oil. We are heating our homes and using air conditioning fueled by natural gas, and that's going to be an ever more important fuel moving forward. We have a lot of resources of natural gas off limits as well. So it really makes sense to me to go ahead and develop those when we can, and with an eye to the future, investing in technology and getting as serious as we possibly can about energy conservation.
Well, I'm going to go to your calls and emails in a moment, but Jim Presser, I want to bring you back here to talk about the fact that Ray Oladour says the thesis that it's an either-or between fossil fuels and green energy is wrong. Maybe the real question is another thesis that we've heard Ms. Dewar advance, and get your response to it, that if we had done this 10, 15 years ago, 5 years ago even, prices would not be at the gas pump what they are now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you just kind of have to, I mean, as far as the amount of resources that are available, I mean, I think it's good to note that 80% of the oil that is developed, can be developed in the Outer Continental Shelf, is currently available and can be developed. Only about 20% is currently in protected areas, and that's according to the Department of Interior's report to Congress a few years ago. So there's already a lot that's not being developed, and they should be focusing on that. And also, it really is a situation where, I mean, if we don't break our addiction soon, we are going to continue being held hostage to, continually rising prices, and continue to being tied to the Middle East and those oil imports. And, it's just, it makes so much sense to start developing new clean and green technologies. And it's really not so much an either or. It is an all and, you know, what we have, there are so many options on the renewable energy and energy efficiency that we need to develop, that we need to pursue those. And, you know, there's just not that much oil left, and, you know, it's really not going to make much of a difference if we do add it. And, you know, data are showing that it won't make a difference in price. So when you balance that against the potential economic and environmental impacts associated with opening new areas to drilling, you really come out on the side of it just doesn't make much sense to open up new areas.
Well, the president, of course, made the opposite argument yesterday, and I just wonder what your response is to part of that argument, which he was advancing, in which he said that there are sophisticated ways now to reach Anwar oil with absolutely no impact on the land or on local wildlife.
Well, in the Arctic Refuge, what we would have is, you know, you have the tundra, basically, and that's a very sensitive environment. If you do things on the land up there, those impacts stay for, you know, a very, very long time. And the infrastructure that would be needed to access that oil would be spread out across the entire, not the entire area where they have development. It wouldn't be so, like, localized. I mean, a lot of people talk about it being a very small area that'd be impacted. Well, the actual footprint of the infrastructure would be, the total area would be small, but it'd be spread out like a spider web over that whole area, and that would disrupt the natural wildlife in that area, as well as also lead to, you know, all kinds of impacts as far as stuff being dug up to drill the wells and other things, and roads and infrastructure. Basically, you're taking a pristine wilderness area that we will be getting our last barrel of oil out of, and you won't have it for future generations. So really, we are in a situation, you were talking earlier about sort of global demand, having such a tight gap between what we have or producing what the demand is. As we continue, we just don't have enough to really, keep up with that demand. I mean, with developing countries really escalating their demand, our solution is not to keep drilling, but rather to, break our addiction and move to these new alternative sources.
Jim Presswood with us from the nation's capital, lead lobbyist on federal energy policy issues with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. And let me go right to your calls. Chuck, good morning.
Morning. Thanks very much. I think that is the case that our gas prices are really substantially lower than lots of parts of the developed world, and have been that way for some time. And I think it's not a coincidence that we also are less efficient in our use of gas than in lots of places where the prices are higher. So if you believe in, as I do, in market-oriented approaches to problems, taking extraordinary measures to lower gas prices, and I think in this case that the amount you can lower it by doing this drilling is probably extremely minimal. But anyway, doesn't the representative from the petroleum industry agree that gas prices are one of the strongest driving forces to the ultimate solution of this problem?
Absolutely. I agree with you entirely, and we're seeing a lot of that going on right now, lots of investment in lots of new technology, and a lot of it by the oil industry, too. And you're right about Europe. They have had high gasoline prices for a long time, decades, and they tax it heavily, and they drive tiny, tiny cars, and they've been doing it for a long time. And had we had policies like that in place, we would be using less energy than we do today. So, sure, I have to agree with that.
Let me thank Chuck for the call. I want to go right to another caller, and that's you. Mark, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I would like to clear up a question. It seems that one of your speakers there talked that electric cars were somehow a magic bullet that would reduce our dependency on oil or gas, and also that hydrogen cars are a magic bullet in this regard. And I think it's easy to confuse the fact that hydrogen and electricity are really ways of moving moving energy around, but are not sources of energy, and you need either gas or oil or nuclear or solar energy to make the electricity that makes the cars move around. And I think that seems to be getting confused here in this conversation.
You want to comment, Jim Presswood?
Sure, and he's absolutely right. Electricity and hydrogen, these are energy carriers. They're not sources of energy. But what we would have if you did have more plug-in hybrids is you wouldn't have to use, gasoline as much as you would otherwise. So, and you can rely on the electricity sector to provide the energy, and that is actually a lot more efficient way of using energy than actually filling up with gasoline. So,
but most of it is fueled by coal these days. We have to think of that too.
Sure, and we do, have.
Yeah, so, what's your position on coal?
Didn't know we were taking, I guess, a debate here.
It's a fair question. What is your position?
It's a fair question. There is definitely a role for coal. I mean, we have, a lot of coal capacity already online.
But not for gasoline?
Yeah. But let me finish. We have a lot of capacity online for coal, but what we're saying is on coal, when you put new units in place, we need to have better technology that can actually capture the carbon dioxide. So, there is a role for coal in the future, but what we need to be doing much more with energy efficiency. California has set a good example of how you can increase the efficiency of your homes. Essentially, California has had per capita energy consumption that's been static since the 70s compared to the rest of the country.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well on that score in the state.
I mean, there are a lot of things that we can do on energy efficiency, clean renewable energy sources to help us out. So I think that it's going to take all those to get the job done. It's not going to be a magic bullet.
I want to go to an email here from a listener named Trevor. And actually, the question is to you, Ray Oladur. He says, please ask your guests who was just commenting on safety and on hurricanes, Katrina and Rita, about the 700,000 gallons spilled and 120-plus small spills around those two hurricanes, according to U.S. Coast Guard.
Oh, they were on land, and they were at refineries, and you know, when that levee broke in Louisiana, there was a lot of damage there to some big storage facilities. So absolutely, that did happen, and to homes, to businesses, and to the refinery industry that's heavily concentrated right in the line of those storms. So they did suffer quite a bit of damage, and they did have the spills. But we are talking about opening up areas in the outer continental shelf up to 200 miles offshore. So when I was talking about spills, I'm talking about the operations within the water in the Gulf of Mexico.
Here's a question, Jim Presswood. I don't know if you really want to handle this or not, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway from
sure.
A listener up in Sebastopol who says, is it probable that there is a casual, if not conspiratorial, relationship between the Bush administration's failure to act on impending oil shortage until it became a crisis and the efforts to open up sensitive areas to exploration? If the cost of oil is high enough, the American people may be more willing to consider allowing oil exploration. Well, you're in Washington.
Yeah, I don't buy that. I definitely think there's a very.
You keep hearing about these oil men who are in the executive suite. So.
I think they're probably pressing the point a little bit too far. But you know, certainly, I think the oil industry could do a lot more in investing in clean, renewable energy sources. Unfortunately, they're spending a lot of their money just buying back stock.
Yeah, but they are buying it. I mean, the oil industry is spending money, are they not?
They absolutely are. They're spending up to $100 billion in new and emerging technologies over this 5 years.
I mean, I hate to come to your defense here, Ray Holland, where you can do that on your
you
own, but
you.
I've done enough programs and studied this situation enough that I know that some of the smart business people who work for the petroleum company said, look, green energy is the future, and let's invest in it. And there's more money coming down those pipelines than there is on a lot of others.
Yeah. But relatively speaking, it's a very small amount. I mean,
core
business, which is developing oil and not investing in renewable energy sources like they could.
Well, listen, these are oil and natural gas companies, and they're in the business of servicing their customers and providing reliable supplies to them. That is the demand, and they are in the business of producing that. But they are also, as our host noted, looking at a portfolio of fuels and investing more than ever moving forward to new, renewable, and different kinds of energy and technology. They have always done this. They always have to have a broad horizon. They're looking 10, 20, 30 years into the future. So they're doing that now. And they're doing that more than I know of any other industry in America.
And they're not necessarily
investing in energy for the future.
Not necessarily trying to save the planet. It's more a profit motive. And
absolutely. You know, they want to be the energy producers. They want to be on the stage. They're investing in a lot of new things coming down the pike. But in the meantime, they are putting most of their money in oil and gas. I mean, no one's asking a renewable fuels person why they're not investing enough in oil. This is their business. That's what they do, and that's where they're putting their money.
Let's hear from Noelle. Noelle, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a chemical engineer. I worked in the oil industry for about 12 years. And the comment that a new discovery can come online in 5 years is a bit disingenuous. I mean, it depends on where the oil is discovered. The last large oil discovery that I participated in confirming the discovery, which was in 1986, came online this year. That's 22 years later. Part of it is because of where it was located. It was up in Alaska. Part of it was the economics of it. But the fact that we could discover oil tomorrow and have it online in 5 years, it really depends on where it is, especially deep water drilling in the Gulf. That's not a five-year plan. So that's my first comment. My second comment is regarding ANWR. A lot of the damage that would be done in ANWR is the heat related to the production of oil. One of the big problems on the North Slope right now is the melting of the permafrost, and that's been a direct result of the heat that's come from the oil production, and that's something that has been very hard to prevent. So those are my comments.
All right. We'll get some response from you. Go ahead, Ray Oladur.
Oh, sure. I, I appreciate those comments. When I said 5 to 10 years, that's the lease turnaround right now. In other words, the leases that we have, you have within 5 to 10 years to develop them. In shallow waters, you can have production within about 5 years, but in deeper waters, surely it depends. But they have to turn these leases back to the government within 10 years if they don't explore and develop on them. So that was the time frame. So we could expect to see anything depending on what's open to us within 5 to 10 years. Since 1995, in the Gulf of Mexico, we've brought on 1 million new barrels a day in those operations there. So if we were able to open up more areas, I believe over the next 10 years, we could see at least 1 million more barrels a day.
That realistic, Jim Presswood, for your preview?
Well, I mean, we're talking very small amounts here that really won't impact prices. I mean, again, we're in a larger view here. We only have 3% of the world's oil reserves. So if you're going to try to impact prices, it just cannot be done through more domestic drilling. And that's, you know, when people are looking for ways to solve this problem, we just have to realize that and, you know, recognize, as President Bush did, you know, former oil man, that we are addicted to oil and we have to break our addiction. And surely the oil and gas industry, they're going to continue to be energy providers, but we need to look at different feedstocks. We need to switch from fossil oil, and look at new sources such as cellulosic biomass and plants and other things like that. And so that's the direction we need to be heading, not sort of these tired old energy policies of the past, such as opening up offshore areas and opening up the Arctic refuge, those sorts of things. We need to be looking at new energy solutions, and that has unfortunately not been the leadership that we've seen from the White House. We've gotten a recognition of the problem, but nothing as far as solving it. And the oil industry has been a big part of the problem in throwing lobbying money at Congress to keep a lot of good things from happening. And specifically, you know, that we had a bill on the floor of the Senate to increase tax incentives or extend tax incentives for renewable energy and energy efficiency. They'd be paid for by rolling back tax breaks to the oil and gas companies. Well, they fought very hard to block that, and they were successful. And now we're looking at different ways to try to pay for it, but they essentially block clean energy from happening.
Well, you got the final word there, because we're at the end of the hour. Jim Presswood, again, lead lobbyist on federal energy policy issues for the Natural Resources Defense Council. We also talked to Rael Adur, who is senior economic advisor of the American Petroleum Institute. I want to thank both of our guests. Thank you, our listeners. And if you'd like to watch the police video that we discussed the first part of this hour with new information about the murder of journalist Chauncey Bailey, you can find it on our website at kqed.org/forum. Thanks to all of you for being with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.